This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions.
Welcome. This is Gary Clinton. You know, I've got a lot of these old radio programs that I like. There are several that are right up there, top notch. But there isn't really anything I enjoy more than the South African version of the BBC television program, The Avengers. It was produced and transmitted in South Africa between the 6th of December of 1971 and the 28th of December 1973. What they did was they adapted scripts that were first aired on the very successful TV show, The Avengers. The show, the radio show, starred Donald Monat as John Steed and Diane Appleby as Emma Peel, who were two top agents of the British Secret Service. The radio show was served up pretty much following the style and tempo established by the television series during its run on the BBC between 1961 and 1969. Just like the television series, the South African radio presentation featured outlandish, quirky villains, crazy scientists, and secret organizations. It's all a little James Bond, a touch of Smersh, a smattering of Spectre, some Napoleon Solo and Ilya Kuryakin, with a hint of Uncle and Thrush, and, oh yeah, just a little Max in 99. Oh, I want to mention that this radio program was originally done as a series of 15-minute episodes, 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, on Springbok Radio. Now, I'm not going to make you tune in for 7 consecutive weeks while I play each time one part of the serial. What I've done, and what I usually do with this show, is I go in and I re-edit it, basically just taking out the capitulation. You know, the part at the beginning of the show where they bring you up to speed on what's happened so far. I figure you don't need that, so I get rid of that. And I also take out the exit. But I do figure that you're probably going to want to know where an episode ends and where the next episode begins. So I've left in a musical clue. Whenever you hear this,
The Avengers.
The program just transitioned from one part of the serial to the next. This particular episode was based on the TV episode called The Interrogators, which premiered in England as part of Season 7 on January the 1st of 1969. This is one of the Avengers South Africa programs that was not based on one of the programs with Diana Rigg. You see, Diana Rigg left in 1968, which, in my opinion, did irreparable damage to the show, and was replaced with a pleasant enough woman called Linda Thorason, who played a character named Tara King. Tara King was no Emma Peel, which was probably smart. I mean, there was just no way that they were going to be able to find an actress who would bring the panache and sense of style that the Diana Rigg brought to Mrs. Peel. However, for the radio show, they just rewrote the segments with Tara King for Diana Appleby and Mrs. Peel. And I gotta tell you, it shows. When I was listening to this show a little bit earlier, I began to suspect. I thought, this is one of those. This is one of those with Tara King. Because Mrs. Peel is not acting like Mrs. Peel. Not really. I mean, there's really only one kind of small scene in which they have Mrs. Peel sitting in the back of a car clutching her little bag. I tell you, Mrs. Peel would not have clutched her little bag. She would have held it. She would have had it in the seat next to her. She would have kicked it. She wouldn't have clutched it. Anyway, I've gone on long enough here.
Now, from the makers of Coldwater Omo,
the two men who were waiting in the corridor late at night were both in uniform. Roy Casper, fresh-faced and rugged, about 30 years of age, is an army lieutenant. Dan Fletcher, sitting alongside him, a young naval officer.
You next?
That's right.
Well, how do you think you're going to stand up to it?
Well, I'm pretty confident. I've passed everything so far. And you?
I don't know. I reckon I'm all right.
It was at that point that the door at the end of the passage opened.
All right, take this one away.
Through the door appeared two men carrying a third, who was clearly an RAF officer. He appeared to be in bad shape. The man in the white smock in the open doorway said,
Next, please.
Well, this is it. Wish me luck.
I will, old man. Be seeing you.
Roy Casper walked down the corridor, squared his shoulders, and entered the room. The door closed. Dan Fletcher looked at the door anxiously and strained his ears. What exactly went on behind that door?
The Avengers. John Steed and Emma Peel, The Avengers.
Episode 1 of this story, in which John Steed and Emma Peel are told of a serious security leak and realize that this will be a case of interrogation. The telephone was the old-fashioned type, fixed against a wooden panel. The mouthpiece jutted out into the corridor. The receiver, with its long, twisted cord, hung in the clasp alongside. John Steed walked over to it, removed the receiver and dialed a number. There was no call sound. Instead, the whole panel began to swing round. Steed entered the opening and replaced the receiver. He was in a large gallery overlooking an office filled with files, desks, and telephones. It was Mother's new headquarters.
Mother! Mother!
Over here, Steed. The cocktail cabinet.
Oh. A bit early for mixing martinis, isn't it?
I grew impatient waiting for you. I knew the moment I started to slice the lemon, you would appear. You will join me?
No, of course. I always like to start the day well. No olives.
Good one. For good health. I have an idea you'll need it.
Thank you. For the drink. Well, what's on your mind, Mother?
Roy Casper, military intelligence.
Casper? A link man to some of our paid informers, isn't he?
That's right. What about his habits?
I think on the whole I'd say they were fairly clean.
I did not ask you if he was house-trained. I mean his social habits, his hobbies, recreations, clubs he might belong to, places he's in the habit of frequenting, people he might see.
Oh, dear.
Oh, dear, there's hardly a reply.
Well, just putting two and two together. Those sort of questions can mean only one thing.
You're right. Casper is missing. Perhaps there's a little too much vermouth in this one.
How long has he been missing?
Hasn't reported in for the past 48 hours.
Well, I presume someone has checked his apartment.
Mrs. Peel is over there at the moment. Ah. Mother?
Emma Peel. I'm at Jasper's apartment. I've been going over the place and there doesn't seem to be anything wrong. Except?
Except?
Well, there doesn't seem... seem to be a clean shirt anywhere in the place.
A clean shirt? What's that got to do with it? I didn't send you on a wild shirt chase.
No, 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 you misunderstand me. I can't find a toothbrush or a razor either.
Huh? Oh. Oh, I see. Well, stay there. I'll send the forensics mob along right away.
Right. Bye.
Bye. Yeah. No sign of a shirt, razor, or toothbrush.
Looks as though he packed and left of his own accord, then.
Exactly my own deduction. But it still doesn't tell us where Casper is, does it?
Casper was sitting in a chair, his wrists bound tightly to the metal arms. A white light blazed into his eyes. He'd been there all night. The man in the white smock, whose name is Blackie, stood over him.
May I have your name, rank, and number again, please?
Roy Casper, Lieutenant 2241-3791.
Good, thank you. You're attached to military intelligence, aren't you, sir? Sir? I asked if you were attached to military intelligence.
My name is Roy Casper, Lieutenant 2241-3791.
I shan't ask you again.
That will do, Sergeant Blackie. I'll take over from here.
From out of the shadows stepped a handsome man of about 40. He wore a black polo neck jersey, black slacks, and high leather boots. He carried a riding crop, which he tapped lightly against his right leg. Colonel Mannering was a saturnine figure.
So, you're feeling brave, Casper. Lieutenant Roy Casper, 2241-3791. Oh, I don't doubt your bravery. We have had many brave men in here, but they all talk, eventually.
You'll get nothing from me. Nothing.
On the contrary, we shall get everything from you. Everything we wish to know.
Colonel Mannering slipped the riding crop under Casper's chin and lifted his bowed head.
Casper. Lieutenant Roy Casper. Look at me. Look at me!
Sleep. Please. Let me sleep.
Sleep? Of course we'll let you sleep. A warm bed, soft pillows, eh? Soft, so soft, soft pillows.
Sleep, sleep.
But not yet.
Lieutenant Roy Casper, 224.
We know you run a string of informers, Casper, men who pay for scraps of information. The names of those men are known to only a select few. You will tell us the names of those men. You will tell me now. Understand? We know that one of these men is a keen archer. Now, we want his name and what he looks like and where he practices his archery. You will tell us now.
Right on target, Wilson. Another bull. Congratulations.
Thank you. I'll collect my arrows, then you show me how the shoot really should be conducted.
Of course.
It was you who challenged me, you know.
But of course. Once I was told that James Wilson was the best archer in this district, I had to find out just how good.
Well, I hope you're impressed.
Extremely impressed. But it doesn't mean I can't win, of course.
Of course not.
I use a rather deadly arrow, actually. It flies like this.
Dan Fletcher, the young naval officer, had followed Roy Casper into the room at the end of the corridor. For him, this was also the testing time.
I won't tell you anything. I won't.
Listen to me, Daniel Fletcher. You had a friend. His name was Roy Casper. He passed through this room ahead of you, didn't he?
Don't know anyone called Casper.
Oh, yes, you do. Or at least you thought you knew him. You thought that he would succeed, maintain his identity, not give anything away. But he did. He told us everything we wanted to know. And the man he identified is now ours. You will be equally cooperative.
No. No, I won't.
Yes. Yes. Yes, you will.
Colonel Mannering began beating a tattoo on his leather boot with the riding crop as he repeated over and over and over again.
Yes, you will. Yes, you will. Yes, you will. Yes, you will.
Just as I thought, this wine doesn't travel at all well.
Unless we hear definite news soon, we'll both be in an advanced state of alcoholism.
And nonetheless, Steed poured himself another glass of chilled wine.
This is the trouble with being the kingpin, Steed. Too much waiting about for other people to mess things up.
You mean you'd rather be out there messing it up yourself?
Mother.
Hello?
Yes, yes. When? Right. Keep me informed. Casper talked.
What?
He blabbed, squealed, spilt the beans, sold out.
I can't believe it.
Well, it's true. Either that or he's been made to talk.
Well, I can't believe that either.
You confound your belief, Steed. One of Casper's undercover informers has just been uncovered and killed. Wilson.
Who else?
Huh? What do you mean, who else?
Well, who else could Casper have betrayed?
He only had one other undercover agent.
Who?
That's most secret. Utterly. Restricted information.
Was. It isn't now if Casper's talking.
Yes, you're right, of course.
Oh, come on, Mother. Tell me his name.
It's Izzy Pound. Clever agent. Uses a fairground as his cover. Battersea Park. His name is Izzy Pound and his incredible marching sound. A one-man band. I've often thought I have a great deal in common with that man.
In Battersea Park, that rather dreary winter morning, there was a rehearsal in progress. A placard read, Izzy Pound and his incredible marching sound. Now in rehearsal. No visitors. Keep out. Izzy Pound was trying out his instruments. They were strapped all over his person. Across the other side of the fairground, next to the rifle range, a man known as Sergeant Blackie paused and placed a rifle to his shoulder.
Izzy Pound! Izzy, I want to talk to you! Stop!
Steve's
Izzy.
Voice was drowned in the cacophony of sounds.
Stop!
So, almost with a rifle shot, Izzy Pound stopped his tuning up and collapsed to the ground.
Avengers.
Steed rushed across the fairground, but Izzy was lying in a heap, his instruments scattered around his body.
Izzy Pound. No, take it easy, Izzy. Take it easy. I'll soon get you out of here.
Just tuning up, trying out my instruments. Nothing wrong in that, is there?
No, of course not. Now just relax. Did you see who shot at you?
No, there's a rifle range over there, but the guns aren't intended to kill.
Let me have a look at you.
Shot between my symbols. A cruel fate.
You'll be all right. Now, look, tell me, Izzy, when did you last see Roy Casper?
Never. I never heard of him.
There's no need to cover up, Izzy. No, this is important. Wilson is dead. Killed at archery practice. There's been a leakage. All undercover agents are in danger, and the one person who's responsible must be Roy Casper. Now, tell me, honestly, do you know where he is?
No. I haven't seen him for 2 days. I was to meet him.
When? Where?
This afternoon. In a bar. A green pheasant auction.
Right. Now, I've got to get you away from here to a place where they can't get at you. Now, don't worry. I'll see you're all right.
But Izzy Pound shook his head slowly. He knew better. Mother was frustrated. He wheeled himself up and down in his new headquarters, picking up phones and barking into them. There had been no news for several hours, and Mother was never a patient man.
Mother?
Mother, Steed here.
At last. What have you to report?
Bad news. They got Izzy Pound.
What?
Now, it's just too late. Pound and his incredible marching sound are no more. It looks to me as though they got at Casper, found out all they wanted to know, and finished him also.
Right. Get over to Casper's apartment, pick up Mrs. Peel, and report back here.
Right.
It seems that everything leads to a dead end. Or a dead man.
And in Casper's apartment, John Steed and Emma Peel were surrounded by the forensic mob.
I must say that when Mother said he'd send the forensic mob here, I thought he was speaking metaphorically. But look at them.
Yes, mob is rather appropriate. Well, what do they hope to achieve? I mean, so many of them.
They're just getting in each other's way.
I think that's all, men. Take the stuff back to the labs and let's have a full report in double quick time.
Well, I've got all the shots I want.
And no more fingerprints in this.
All right, yeah, break it up there. Get going.
Okay, chaps, let's go.
We overlooked nothing, Mr. Steed.
How about the ashtray on the window ledge?
Roy Casper was, is a non-smoker. Now, what's this?
Now, this cigarette stub is a hand-rolled, custom-made mixture of Virginian Turkish tobaccos and has preponderance of oriental herbs.
Smoked by?
A right-handed man of average build.
Safe guess. A preponderance of oriental herbs, eh?
Well, of course, that's just in the nature of a wild guess at the moment. I'll be able to confirm my findings when we get back to the laboratory. But the oriental herbs are there, sure of that.
What do you think, Steve?
I think Casper had the wrong kind of visitor. Thanks, Norton.
Well, thank you, Mr. Steed, Mrs. Peel. Bye for now.
Oriental?
We need more than a cigarette stub to answer that, Mrs. Peel. A lot more. And so far, we haven't the slightest clue as to Casper's whereabouts. He might be anywhere, if he's still alive.
I think we must presume that Casper is dead.
Well, it is the most logical assumption.
And yet...
Yes, Mrs. Peel?
Yet I've got a strange feeling he isn't.
Well, at least we haven't found his body.
Casper only had two pieces of information of any real value to the enemy.
And both of those pieces are now dead.
Precisely. So Casper has outlived his usefulness to them.
Whoever them might be.
Absolutely.
Dangerous to deal in absolutes.
What do you mean?
Well, what happened to Casper? Was he grabbed or did he go voluntarily? What happened in that apartment of his? What happened to make him pack shirts, razor, toothbrush, and disappear? I mean, if he was grabbed, this wouldn't have happened. There was no signs of a struggle. So we must assume that he went of his own accord.
And you are hoping he is going to come back of his own accord. I think that highly unlikely, Steed.
The point is, where do we go from here?
Well, Steed?
Oh, that's easy. Let me take you to luncheon, Mrs. Peel, at the Green Pheasant in Oxon.
Ready?
What do you hope to find here, Steve?
Well, this was the rendezvous between Casper and Izzy Pound. They had a date here about now. Pound can't keep the appointment for obvious reasons, but maybe...
You're an optimist, I must say. Mother's right, Steve. Casper only had two contacts. Now they're both gone. What point could anyone have in keeping Casper alive?
I don't know. Another beer?
No, thanks. I've had enough. I've almost had enough of this case, too. If there is a case.
Oh, there is, all right. And there's something to be said for being an optimist after all. Look who's just come in. Roy Casper.
A rather bewildered Roy Casper was taken firmly by the shoulder and propelled outside before he could even order himself a drink. Steed and Mrs. Peel were in no mood for talk. Having got Casper back, they took him straight to Mother.
All right, Casper, let's go through it again.
I've told you everything a dozen times.
Nevertheless, we'd like to hear it again.
Now, you took a few days off.
Yes.
Without informing the department.
No. I mean, yes. I mean... I didn't think.
Oh, come, Casper. You've been out of training school 6 years now. You know the rules.
I didn't think.
To think is the first rule to learn.
I wasn't on any special assignment. I took a few days off, took my car and toured around.
Where? We want names and places, Casper. Where did you go?
The South Coast.
Where on the South Coast?
Everywhere. Anyway, I stayed at pubs most of the time.
Names and places.
We want to help you, Casper.
I toured around, that's all. Just toured.
What about your head? Plaster on your forehead. Did you knock your head on a low beam in one of those pubs? Nasty. And nasty bruises you've got on your neck, too.
I fell down.
Where? Names, places.
I can't remember. You're confusing me.
On the contrary, Casper, you are confusing us.
Right, let's go over it all again.
Just a moment, Steve. Give him a few moments to collect his senses. And perhaps you'd... Care for a drink, eh, Casper? Back you up a bit, eh?
Thank you, Mother.
fancy interrogation techniques are all very well, but personally, I think there's nothing makes men crack faster.
Well, a crashing hangover. Well, go ahead, Mother.
Oh, Mrs. Peel, may I pour you a drink also?
Thank you, Steve.
Mrs. Peel, Caspar trained with a chap named Minnow. Very close friends, might be able to help us break him. Go and fetch him.
Minnow?
Charles Minnow. A sprat to catch a mackerel and a minnow to catch, well, who knows?
Leave it to me.
But by the time Mrs. Peel had traced Charles Minnow's address and driven over to his home, it was quite late. Too late, because as she rang the bell, Colonel Mannering looked at Minnow.
Expecting someone, Minnow?
No, Colonel Mannering.
You wouldn't lie to us, would you, Minnow?
I promise you, I'm expecting no one.
Then get rid of whoever it is. We'll leave by the back stairs. Get your things, a suitcase, change of clothes, shaving gear, toothbrush. Then let's get going, Minnow. Now!
The Avengers.
Minnow moved swiftly to the intercom switch, connected to the front door.
Yes, who is it?
Charles Minnow, this is Emma Peel. I'd like to see you right away.
Say you just got out of the bath and haven't dressed.
Oh, Mrs. Peel, I'm afraid you've caught me undressed. I've just got out of the bath. Can you give me a few minutes?
I'll wait.
Right, be down as soon as I can.
Come along then, Minnow. Let's get moving. The back service stairs.
All right. Oh, just a minute.
What is it?
I almost forgot something. My toothbrush.
The interrogation of Caspar would have to take place without Minnow's help.
Right. Come along then, Caspar. Let's go through it again.
Again, I've told you everything I can. I just took a couple of days off. I went on a tour.
Yes, but I want it in detail. From the beginning, every detail, every minute of the journey, every nuance of your unofficial holiday. Now, you decided to take a few days off.
Yes.
You drove away from your home on your own.
Yes.
And your first stop was Salisbury. You stayed at a public house? What pub?
I don't know. I forgot. Oh, for pity's sake, can't you see I'm tired? Tired of questions, always questions. The past few days I've had enough.
Yes, Caspar, the past few days, what? You had enough questions?
The past few days are what we are interested in, Caspar. Questions from whom, Caspar? Concerning what?
Look, what's this all about anyway? You've been interrogating me for hours now, and you won't tell me what it's all about. Try to make me drunk, you won't let me go home. I've got a right to know what this means, haven't I?
A right? Yes, I suppose you have. All right, Steed, show him.
Silently, John Steed moved to the door, opened it, and wheeled in another bath chair similar to that in which Mother sat. The chair was covered with a white cloth. Steed took the edge.
Does this answer your question?
As he spoke, he whipped the cloth away. The body of Izzy Pound, with some of his musical instruments still attached to his clothing, fell to the floor.
Izzy Pound? It's a trick.
Take his wrist. Take it. Feel his flesh. That's dead flesh.
But nobody knew about him. Nobody except...
Me and you, Caspar. Me and you.
You can't think... You think I...
Caspar, you were missing for 3 days. Now, where were you?
I can't tell you.
Can't?
Someone's got some sort of hold over you, is that it? They're holding a friend or a relative hostage.
No, nothing like that. I can't tell you. Not yet. Give me time to think, please. Please.
Steed looked at Mother. Mother gave a hardly perceptible nod.
Very well, Caspar. Take all the time you want. You sleep on it. Come back and see us tomorrow and we'll talk about it then.
Tomorrow?
That's right. Or the day after. No hurry.
I can go home?
That's right, Caspar. Good night.
Good night.
Steed and Mother smiled as the bewildered and exhausted young man left them. After he'd gone...
It's the best way.
Oh, definitely.
Might have remained here all night waiting for him to crack.
As you say, he's been got at by someone. He turned up at the Green Pheasant to meet Pound, and he was genuinely shocked at seeing the body.
Give him a few minutes' start. I'd say about now.
Yes, I'll get after him. He's frightened, all right, and he'll lead us straight to them.
Amazing new biotechs act with a biological action to soak out the stubbornest stains and loosen dirt. New biotechs is great for all textiles and synthetics, whites and colors. It contains no bleach. Get amazing new biotechs today and let soaking do the washing.
Emma Peel, outside Minnow's apartment, got impatient. She took a small vanity case out of her handbag and snapped it open. Inside was a variety of gadgets, all suitable for picking the locks of doors. A few minutes later, she was inside, climbed the stairs, and broke into Minnow's rooms. It only took a moment to realize what had happened. She phoned Mother.
Mother?
Mother speaking. What news, Mrs. Beale?
I'm at Minnow's place, and I don't like it.
You mean the color of the walls, or the furniture not to your taste?
I mean, I don't like the situation. Minnow was here. I spoke to him from outside, but he left quite suddenly.
Oh, you mean he made a getaway down the back stairs?
That's right. The apartment is exactly like Casper's was. The only thing that appeared to be missing are clothing, shaving tackle, and his toothbrush.
John Steed had parked his car outside Casper's block of flats. He looked up at the lighted windows and waited. The next light to go would almost surely be Casper's. But Roy Casper avoided the main rooms and went straight to the kitchen at the back of his apartment. There, he bent down near the sink and picked up a wicker basket. He placed it on the kitchen table and opened it.
There. There. Come along, my pretty one. Come along.
He held the pigeon very tenderly and moved quickly to the kitchen window, throwing it open. Casper leaned out of the window and released the pigeon. Its wings flapped loudly. It took to the air above the chimney tops and vanished into the night. In a small, darkened room many miles away in a country house, Charles Minnow staggered backwards and forwards, his hands over his ears, the sweat running down his face, for the room reverberated with ear-piercing shrieks coming from huge tannoy speakers.
Stop it! Stop it! Stop it!
The door opened, and Colonel Mannering came in.
Which is worse, Minnow? Sound? Or not knowing when the sound will begin again.
Please, please.
You now become your own torturer. When your brain keeps asking, when will it start again? You steel yourself against the moment, tense every nerve, but the sound doesn't come. And then, suddenly...
Ah! No!
It's the psychological approach. Sergeant Blackie and others do not entirely approve. They place more faith in the older, more physical methods. And I can't condemn them out of hand now, can I? Not without allowing the sergeant to prove his point first.
Excuse me, sir.
Ah, Blackie. We were just discussing you and your methods.
May I have a word with you? Private, please, Colonel.
Oh, very well. Take a breather, you know. And a good think. Remember, unless you tell us everything we want to know, this is only the beginning. I shall be back. Very shortly. Well, Blackie, what is it?
I think you ought to see this, sir.
Blackie opened his enormous hands. There was the pigeon.
When did it arrive?
A few minutes ago, sir.
It's Casper's pigeon, isn't it? Roy Casper?
That's right.
Trouble. You'd better get back to town at once. I'll allow you an hour and then phone him. We can't allow this to continue, Blackie.
Of course not. You want me to...
With your customary skill, yes.
And so the evening passed. Steed keeping a careful watch upon Casper's apartment and reporting occasionally to Mother.
All quiet on the Casper front at the moment, Mother.
Good. Don't want to keep you up all night, Steed. But sometime that boy is going to get in touch with them.
I know. How about Minnow? Mrs. Peel managed to get him?
We've run into a small problem there, too.
Problem?
Mrs. Peel will deal with it. Don't worry. Stick with Casper.
Right. night. Good night, Mother.
Good night. Impossible.
Roy Casper speaking.
Casper, Colonel Mannering here. Message received.
Oh, thank goodness you've called, Colonel. Everything's gone wrong. A contact's been murdered and I've been held and interrogated. They think it's me. I've been questioned for hours and I didn't know how much to tell them. I don't know what to do.
Calm down, calm down, Lieutenant Casper. That's an order. They didn't get anything out of you. You obeyed my orders exactly.
Exactly. I didn't tell them anything about you or the organization.
Then there's nothing to worry about. You've done a splendid job. I'll contact the proper authorities right away. I'll clear you absolutely. There'll be no more questions. Now listen.
But while Colonel Mannering was reassuring Casper, a figure was creeping silently up the fire escape outside. It was Sergeant Blackie, and in his right hand he held a revolver. Mother was right. The night wasn't going to be a good one.
The Avengers.
Nothing to worry about, McCoy. You just leave it all to me.
Yes, sir. But there is still so much I don't understand.
There's no need for you to understand. You do as you're told.
Yes, sir. Yes, of course, sir.
Yes. May inquire in your own apartment.
Yes, but they suspect I'm guilty.
I've told you I will clear you.
But Izzy Pound is dead. What about that murder, sir? I was the only one who knew him.
I have told you there is nothing to worry about.
But there was. For the man outside on the fire escape had succeeded in opening the window and slipping inside. Roy Casper was so intent on his phone conversation that he didn't hear the door open slowly. Blackie raised the revolver. On the other end of the line, the colonel heard the shot and the crash as Casper, dead before he reached the floor, fell heavily across the telephone, taking it with him. Colonel Mannering smiled.
Splendid. Splendid, Blackie.
The colonel replaced his own receiver with a smile of satisfaction. Downstairs in the street, John Steed's keen ears caught the sound of the shot. He left his car and raced into the building, tearing up to Casper's apartment. He burst in through the door.
Casper! Casper!
Oh no.
Oh, yes. The body lay sprawled amongst the upturned table and telephone, a vase of flowers, spilt water mixing with the blood on the carpet, and next to Casper's right hand was an ugly, black-snouted revolver. It looked as though Roy Casper, riddled with guilt by his own actions, had taken the easy way out. Next morning, Emma Peel also made a thorough search of a flat. This time it was Charles Minow's. And she had Norton, the forensic expert, with her.
We've been all over everything, Mrs. Peel.
So I see. The place looks like it. You must call in on me when I'm next spring cleaning. Anything interesting?
This. A cigarette end, very similar to the one we found in Roy Casper's flat when he disappeared. Hand-rolled custom-made mixture of Virginian and Turkish tobaccos with...
A preponderance of Oriental herbs, right?
Right.
Excuse me.
Mrs. Peel made for the phone. In his headquarters, Mother put down a dry sherry he was sipping and answered the call.
Mother?
We found something at Minnow's, a cigarette stub. Exactly the same brand as that found in Roy Casper's place. It's hand-rolled, custom-made mixture of Virginian Turkish tobaccos, with a preponderance of Oriental herbs. What do you think?
I think it's revolting. Quite spoilt my sherry.
It proves there's a link.
It proves there's a kink, too. You better watch your step, Mrs. Peel. Any man who'd smoke such a nauseating mixture must be evil incarnate.
But don't you see? It's the same pattern as before. Whoever grabbed Casper has now grabbed Minnow.
We don't know for certain that Casper was grabbed.
Just the same.
Just the same. We must assume the worst. You're quite right, yes.
You mean Minnow will talk?
If it's the same pattern, then of course he will talk. And that means betraying his contacts. Minnow's number one contact is a fellow called Fillington. He's a professional footballer. You'd better get to him and tip him off. This is one game in which he really will have to keep his eye on the ball.
When Steve joined Mother later that morning, Mother wasn't very happy. He was even less happy when he heard of Casper's death the night before.
He couldn't be deader. He was shot in an attempt to make it look like suicide. It wasn't, of course.
I suppose it could have been.
No, just looks like it. Casper was told to go away and think things over. Izzy Pound's death really shook him. Now, I swear he would have come clean sooner or later. Now, that's why they wiped him out.
They? Who are they?
Yes, well, that's just the point, isn't it? Who are they?
Mrs. Peel rang up. Minnow's missing. Mrs. Peel has found evidence to suggest there's been a similar snatch. It might be a complete repeat performance. Mrs. Peel's on her way to warn Fillington. He's Minnow's number one contact.
Well, let's hope it's not a repeat performance. Let's hope Fillington's still alive and kicking.
Fillington was alive and kicking. He was in a grassy field near his home, booting the ball against a tree.
46, 47.
Mrs. Peel, at the wheel of her sports car, was driving the roads around the area, searching Fillington. She saw him and screamed to a stop. Fillington missed the tree. The football rolled towards a small clump of bushes. Fillington made after it, just as Mrs. Peel drew up. As Fillington approached the bushes, the snout of a rifle pushed its way through the leaves. Fillington picked up the ball and started heading it. Mrs. Peel yelled from the near road.
Mr. Fillington! Mr. Fillington!
Fillington spun round. His head hit the ball just as the bullet hit his head.
Mother?
Mother? Mrs. Peel, too late.
Fillington?
Is dead.
Dead. I see.
This confirms it, doesn't it? Minnow has talked.
Looks like it. It's all systems go from now on.
I'm ready. Just give me the name of Minnow's second contact.
It's a street vendor. He has a stall in Bridgewell Road. His name is Herbert Puffin.
Got it. Herbert Puffin. Street vendor, Bridgewell Road. So that's Minnow's second contact.
Colonel Mannering was working on much the same lines.
Your second contact. The name of your second contact, Minnow. Now, come on, man. The name of your second contact. Give it to me. Give me his name.
No! I say, escape attempts are allowed here, aren't they?
Certainly.
Good. I wouldn't want to break the rules, you know. I say, you've hurt your hand.
It's nothing.
Well, just the same, I'd put something on if I were you, sir. That was an awfully good punch, if you'd allow me to say so. I should think you've done a fair amount of boxing in the ring.
Well, I did box my battalion.
Really? Then you know old Gnosha Wright.
We were in the same team together.
Yeah, splendid man, Gnosha.
First class.
Salt of the earth, but...
Enough of this! The name of your second contact, tell me now! His name, Minnow! His name!
Bridgewell Road is nearly always busy. On the day Mrs. Peel called, it was unusually so. She searched for the street vendor, Herbert Puffin, and eventually found his store. A sign above it read H. Puffin, balloon for every occasion. H. Puffin was occupied blowing up balloons from a small cylinder of gas. Balloons on various lengths of string bobbed all around him.
Mr. Puffin! Mr. Puffin!
Yes.
Mr. Puffin, you're in great danger.
Danger? A gentle, silly old man, balloon seller like me. How could I possibly be in danger?
Look, I'm Emma Peel. Mother sent me here. Look, my identification.
The old man peered at the card Emma Peel held out. His manner changed. So did his accent.
Mother sent you, huh? What's the problem?
Minnow, there's been a leak. His first contact's dead. We think you're known. If so, they'll be after you too.
Well, thanks for the warning. Perhaps I'd better pack and get...
Down!
As Puffin and Emma Peel dropped for cover behind the stall, balloons began to burst around them. Bullets sang out.
He's got us a bit pinned down, I'm afraid.
Yes, let's counterattack. Set these balloons free and burst a few of the others.
Blackie, the assassin, moved to the back of the stall. People in the street laughed as the balloons exploded. Mrs. Peel was waiting for Blackie. She jumped him.
Ah! Oh!
The gun dropped to the pavement. Old Puffin grabbed it. Mrs. Peel was thrown. Blackie staggered back, picked up the sharp scissors Puffin had been using to cut his string, and plunged forward, using them as a dagger. He drew his arm back, ready to stab, when... Puffin stood amongst the wreckage of his store, the revolver in his hand.
Funny. I'm so old, and yet that's the first man I've ever killed.
The Avengers.
A dead man is a dead end, Steve.
Yes, see what you mean. He can't lead us to whoever he was working for.
That's right. Still, it has proved quite a few things.
But Minnow must have talked.
Yes.
Now, what's happened to old Puffin?
Well, the balloon went up in every sense. He folded his stall up and disappeared in double quick time. I don't think he'll be around for some time. Oh, I've no doubt he'll make the contact when things have cooled off. Meanwhile,
a full report to Mother. Any idea who the would-be assassin is?
Mm-mm. New to me. The boys at headquarters will run a complete check on the body. They may come up with something.
I wonder what our chances are of picking up Minnow.
Slight.
I'm not so sure. After Casper's two contacts have been killed, he turned up as though nothing had happened. Minnow could do the same.
Well, not once they realize we've killed that man. Could be that he arranged all the other deaths. If we've knocked him out, then they may silence Minnow once and for all. He has no more contacts.
It could be. Oh, well, let's think of the inner man and not the link man. Lunch, Mrs. Peel?
That afternoon, in Mother's headquarters, Steed and Mother sat over coffee, staring at the forensic reports and photographs.
Well, this is a pretty kettle of fish. Report is clear enough. Accurate description of the man, fingerprints, photographs.
We don't know him. No one does. No police record, nothing.
Even I don't know him. And I pride myself on knowing everyone.
Yes, he's a new fellow, all right.
The whole thing is new. The entire situation. There must be a new organization working. This is dangerous.
And baffling. We haven't got a clue on him.
Anonymous. Like that chap in the photograph. What the devil?
Someone wants to join us.
Well, I'm not expecting anyone.
The concealed door at the top of the gallery started to swing inwards. Someone outside had known the correct number to dial in order to enter Mother's headquarters. Not many people had that privilege.
Minnow's the last link. If only we could find Minnow.
Someone looking for me?
Minnow!
Well, I was just on my way home. But I thought I'd better pop in just in case something urgent had cropped up.
I don't believe it.
Well, then. What's been happening in the jolly old world of intrigue, eh?
Mother looked at Steed. Steed looked at Mother, and they both looked towards the liquor cabinet.
Have a drink, Minnow.
Jolly decent of you, Mother.
A large one, Mother.
A very large one, Steed. fine weather for this time of the year, eh?
Well, a little cold, sir. Your drinks.
Thank you, Steed. And I'll give you a toast. To absent friends. Will you drink to that, Minnow?
Yes, sir, of course. Cheers.
Absent friends like this man.
Mother shot a photograph of Blackie across the table at Minnow.
Who? Blackie?
You know him?
Yes, of course I do. It's Sergeant Blackie. He works at... No. I'm not falling for that one. They warned me you might try to trip me up a little.
I'll trip you up.
Faking Blackie's death like that.
That is no fake, Minnow.
Oh, come now.
That is no fake, Minnow. That man, Blackie, or whatever his name is, was shot and killed while attempting to murder Mr. Puffin.
Puffin? But that's ridiculous. How could anyone possibly know about Puffin?
That is what we want you to tell us.
Is he really dead?
Really? We could run you down to the morgue to see for yourself, but that'd be a waste of time. And we don't have time to waste, Minnow. No time at all. Now talk.
Well, I don't know. Well, I ought to contact Mannering first.
Mannering?
Colonel Mannering.
Who's he?
Oh, now come on, Mother. Surely you must know.
I do not know a Colonel Mannering. You will please explain what you're talking about.
If you don't mind, I think I'd like to sit down.
You'd better. Sit down and start from the very beginning, Minnow. We want to know everything.
Mrs. Peel was taking a quiet rest, her feet up and a harmless novel on her lap, when the doorbell rang.
Oh, coming! Yes?
Mrs. Peel? Mrs. Emma Peel?
Yes?
Colonel Mannering, Interdepartmental Security, Head of Oriental Military Studies, my identity cards.
Mannering handed over an elaborate wallet.
You'd better come in.
Thank you. I'd be obliged if you would give the identification papers more than just a cursory glance, Mrs. Peel. I want to be sure that you know exactly who I am and what I represent.
Oh, Of course.
Mrs. Peel studied the papers.
Perhaps you would be good enough to let me see your own identification papers.
Of course.
Mrs. Peel opened a drawer in the desk, took out a wallet, and handed it to Mannering.
Thank you.
You're awfully cautious.
I have to be. You watch others, Mrs. Peel. We watch you.
Big brother, hmm?
We would like to think our interest was more, paternal.
Would you like a drink?
No, thank you. Drinking whilst on duty is something we discourage amongst our operatives.
Too bad. I'm not on duty at the moment.
Do I take it that you are Colonel Mannering?
I'll get right to the point, Mrs. Peel. I have orders here to escort you to Center 53, where you will attend the TOHE Refresher Course A7. Perhaps you would like to examine these orders?
I'll take your word for it.
Oh, please, I'd rather you didn't. Here.
Mrs. Peel took the documents and scanned them.
You'll see the course is covered under Secret Security Sealed Instructions Number 47, subsection QR9432.
It says the course is to start immediately.
As of this moment, yes.
But I've been working full out on an assignment for the past 24 hours without a break.
And you're tired?
Very.
Precisely why the course starts immediately, Mrs. Peel. When you are weary, when your endurance can be taxed to the limit.
But the assignment I'm on hasn't finished yet.
It has, as far as you are concerned. Naturally, you have a right to complain to a higher authority. Perhaps you might like to pick up that telephone and call Mother?
I might just do that.
You have already committed a cardinal error, admitting to me that Mother even exists. That will cost you 10 demerit points. A bad start.
Mannering picked up the phone and placed it in Mrs. Peel's hand.
Well, go ahead. Make the call. Although I can assure you it won't do you any good. After all, he selected you for the course.
Very well, Colonel Mannering. But what is the TOHE course, anyway?
A test of human endurance.
In Mother's headquarters, Minnow had been answering questions yet again. Poor Minnow didn't know which side he was on by the time he'd finished.
The TOHE course? Test of human endurance? That's right. That's what he said. The TOHE. Refresher course, A7.
Never heard of it. Well, only one way to find out. Hello, Mother speaking. Put me through to security internal. Security internal? What do you know about TOHE refresher course A7? Yes, A7. Well, get hold of someone who does know and ring me back.
Minnow, you say you were taken to Center 53.
Yes, that's right.
Well, where is it?
In the country. A large house.
Yes, but where?
Well, I don't know. It was part of the security arrangements that I shouldn't know. I was taken there in a closed van. A small, black, closed van.
A small, black, closed van was moving away from the pavement outside Mrs. Peel's apartment. In the front seat, next to the driver, smiling grimly, was Colonel Mannering. Inside, clutching a small suitcase, was Mrs. Peel. You're still lagging way behind, Steed.
The Avengers.
The small, black, closed van turned up the driveway of a country house. It stopped at the front door. The back doors of the van were opened, and Mrs. Peel got out, blinking at the light. Colonel Mannering led her up the steps and into the reception room. At the desk, a man in Army Sergeant's uniform said...
Good afternoon, miss.
Good afternoon.
Identification, please.
Mrs. Peel produced the necessary papers.
Thank you. Sign here, please, Mrs. Peel.
As Mrs. Peel was signing the register, a door opened and a young man staggered out. He looked very disheveled and worn out, eyes bloodshot and clothes torn.
Emma Peel. Didn't know you were coming here. Remember me, Paul Mullard. We were in training together.
Why, yes. Yes, of course. How are you, Paul?
I'm doing okay, I think. See you in the bar later. Look forward to that.
Come on, you. We haven't finished with you yet. Come here.
This is the key to your room, Mrs. Peel. I trust you enjoy your stay.
Thank you. I think perhaps enjoy is the wrong word, isn't it, Colonel Mannering?
We can at least start off, definitely, Mrs. Peel. Let's have a drink in the bar, shall we?
Mannering placed a hand under Mrs. Peel's elbow and guided her towards a door. Inside, the bar was filled with officers of all ranks.
I think you will enjoy it in here. Once you're settled in, We've got a jolly fine bunch here. Fine, spirit of comradeship. And we try to make everyone stay as comfortable as possible.
They appear jolly enough.
Plenty of recreations, too. Sports, that kind of thing. I'm particularly concerned about the men's well-being. Afternoon, Johnson.
Afternoon, sir.
Johnson, an RAF man, grinned with a split lip and adjusted a piece of sticking plaster that covered a bruise on his forehead.
Gentlemen, may I introduce Mrs. Emma Peel? This is by sacrosanct. It's the only place in the whole building where you can relax, where you can switch off. But let me remind you, the course has begun. You may be taken from here and interrogated at any time. Any time at all.
In Mother's headquarters, the bewildered Minnow goes over it all again.
So, Minnow, the course was to test your breaking point, your reliance as an agent.
Well, that's what Colonel Mannering said. He had papers to prove it.
Mother? Yes. Yes. Thank you. The course was A7 under the direction of Colonel Mannering?
Yes, Mother, that's it.
Doesn't exist.
But surely...
No course A7 and no Colonel Mannering.
It's clever. You have to admit it's clever.
Turning our own secret bureaucracy into a weapon.
That's right. Tied us up with our own red tape, and it's so simple.
Persuade our agents the course is genuine, get their full cooperation, and then interrogate them for as long as they like.
Until they talk.
But that isn't true. It isn't. I got a Class 1 pass mark. They interrogated me for hours, but I didn't talk. I didn't tell them a darn thing. I swear I didn't talk.
You didn't? Well, then how the devil do they work it?
How? Like this.
Name, my lord. Give me the name.
No.
Yes, my lord. Yes. I want this name. Give me the name, my lad. The name. The name. The name.
No. No.
Very good, my lad. Jolly good show. First class.
You mean that that's it?
We haven't been able to break you. I don't think we ever could.
You mean it's really over?
All over. Except the congratulations. You've passed. Class 1.
Oh, thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
Come along, I'll buy you a drink. 2 or 3, if you like. I expect you feel you deserve one.
And so, to the bar.
Well done, my lord! Well done!
Jolly good show!
How about another, sir?
Not just at the moment. I've had 3 straight already. You know, sir, I thought you were kidding me about the Class 1 pass, I mean. Have I really got one?
Take my word for it. Mind you, it was touch and go at one point.
Mind telling me why, sir?
Well, I suppose it can't do any harm now that the whole thing's over. It was when we were questioning you about your contact in Hong Kong. I thought we had you a couple of times there, but you held out. Kept denying you had such a contact. Ah, that's good. Say it again, please, Barker.
Yes, sir.
Mind you, the fact that you don't have a contact in Hong Kong must have helped.
Oh, but I do, sir.
No.
Afraid, sir, huh?
Well, you really did well then, didn't you? I didn't suspect you for one moment. You fooled us completely.
Your drinks, gentlemen.
Oh, thank you. Cheers. Yes, you covered the whole thing brilliantly. Who is he, by the way? Someone I know?
I doubt it, sir. Name's George Criddle.
What? Oh, Georgie?
The new name.
Well... If he's the chap I'm thinking of.
No, tall chap, glasses, fair, moustache.
That's him. George Criddle. Tall, glasses, fair, moustache. Well, just imagine that. I say, it'd be great to get in touch with him after all this time. Where can I reach him?
Well, I usually contact him at the Fu Young Bar.
George Criddle, the Fu Young Bar, Hong Kong. Must remember that, my lad. Cheers.
Back at Mother's, Minnow is still thinking it out.
I can't see how they could have worked it, Mother.
Hypnosis, perhaps.
No, I'd know. I'm sure I'd know.
You were drugged. They got you under drugs?
They didn't.
They must have tricked the information out of you in some way.
But that's impossible. Look, from the moment I went into that place, I was on guard. The whole time they were at me, I was watching every point. I didn't relax for one moment. I never told any.
Yes?
Oh. The bar.
Okay, we got a little bit of a break here. Be right back.
In the bar after it was all over. That's how it must have happened. In the bar, the one place where we were allowed to relax, to lower defenses, swap confidences. Oh, I'm sorry, Mother.
Sorrow is a negative after-the-event emotion, Minnow. What we want now is positive thought. Attack.
What do you suggest, Mother? Mother?
Norton here, Mother. Forensic.
Yes, Norton, what is it?
I'm at Spiel's apartment. I called to give her my findings on the Casper and Minnow cases, sir.
Which are?
Negative, sir.
Only forensics will make a special trip to tell you that they haven't found anything. Get to the point, Norton. Or better still, let me speak to Mrs. Peel.
That's the whole point, sir. She isn't here.
What?
And I found another of those cigarette stubs. The one with the gold filter. They have Turkish and...
Yes. We don't want to hear about that filthy concoction. I can guess the rest. Some clothes are missing.
That's right, sir.
And tell me. And her toothbrush. That's all we need.
Mother slammed the receiver back into its cradle and glared at Minnow.
Mrs. Peel is taking a refresher course. Where is that Center 53? You've got to remember, Minnow.
I just can't. I don't know.
Don't you understand? They've taken Emma Peel. She's different to you and Casper. She's brighter, sharper, more intelligent. Now, they may fool her for a while. Their plan's clever enough to fool anyone for a while. But sooner or later, she's going to realize what's going on. And then, she won't last 5 seconds.
You were taken to a country house?
Yes.
A large house?
Yes.
Old or new?
Old.
How old?
50 years. 100,
think,
I can't...
Minnow, think! There must be something.
Now, just a minute. Now, you thought we were tricking you with Blackie's death. You thought it was a test to make sure you wouldn't reveal the details of the course A7. Now, what if it all went wrong? What if you'd found yourself on trial for treason? What then?
Then I'd contact Colonel Mannering and he'd clear me. Of course! I have a pigeon, a homing pigeon. Well, I can release it. It goes straight to Center 53.
Oh, come on, get that pigeon and we may get Mrs. Peel and Colonel Mannering.
The Avengers.
John Steed called for a helicopter immediately, and from a spare piece of ground near Minnow's apartment, prepared for action.
Right. Release her on a sign from me, Minnow.
Right. And the best of luck, sir.
Okay, pilot. Start her up.
Very good, Mr. Steed.
Ready?
All ready.
Right. Let her go now, Minnow.
Minnow opened the wicker basket. The pigeon fluttered out, stretched its wings, and took to the sky.
Right. Follow that pigeon.
In the interrogation room at Center 53, Colonel Mannering paced up and down, slapping his riding crop against a well-polished black boot. The door opened, and two burly officers pushed Mrs. Peel into the room.
Manners make it man.
Come in and sit down, Mrs. Peel.
That's a little more polite. Thank you, Colonel.
We'll begin with all you know about John Steed.
All? You've got to be joking. Neither of us could have that amount of time.
Colonel Mannering slammed his riding crop down hard on the table.
You will take this interrogation seriously, Mrs. Peel. There will be no sleep, no food, no water until you cooperate.
Oh, can't I even have a cigarette? One of those awful ones that are custom-made with Virginia and Turkish tobaccos and a preponderance of Oriental herbs.
What?
You're careless the way you leave them around, aren't you? I should have thought with your training, you'd not have been so careless.
Enough! You will talk. Tell me everything I want to know. Everything. Where is Steed at this moment? Where is he?
John Steed was hanging on like grim death as the helicopter skidded about in the skies above Center 53. They'd lost sight of Minnow's pigeon.
Oh, can't see it anywhere now, sir.
I'd better go down. She must have gone to roost down there. Let's see what lies below, shall we?
Right.
The helicopter descended rapidly, Steed peering through a pair of binoculars. The pigeon had gone to roost, all right. It fluttered in and settled on the reception desk. Sergeant Rasker picked it up.
I say, Rasker, someone in trouble?
Looks like it, Mr. Mullard. Let's see. Yes, this is Minnow's pigeon, isn't it? The colonel will have to be informed at once.
The colonel was still busy with Mrs. Peel. She was undergoing that wretched sound treatment.
The truth, Mrs. Peel, the truth about John Steed.
He doesn't know himself. How should I know? I'm not my partner's keeper.
I thought I've almost told you never to interrupt an interrogation, Rasker.
Sorry, sir, but this just arrived. It's Minnow's.
I see. Right. One of your men, take over here.
Right, Colonel.
Mannering left the room and marched angrily along the corridor.
Well, it's Minnow's pigeon, all right, Colonel.
That I can see for myself.
And there's been a helicopter following it.
What?
Just reported landing in the grounds.
Steed. It must be John Steed. They're onto us. Get two men and cover the rear entrance to the bar.
That's all very well, sir. But it's a big ass. There are at least a dozen other ways in.
And there'll be an armed man on every one. Open the armory, all the guns you can find. I'll summon our trainees. Sound the emergency alarms. This must be a general call.
All right, sir. Right, sir.
A few moments after that, bells rang throughout the center, followed by the sounds of running feet as the men rushed to the main hall for instructions.
What's going on?
Well, gentlemen, are we all here?
Where's Charlie?
Good. Now, this is the nature of a surprise test. We have arranged for an intruder to break into the center. Your task will be to deploy and find him. We'll each be armed with a pistol. Pistols will be loaded with the blanks, of course. Rasker, how are the pistols?
Yes, sir.
When you find the intruder, you will shoot to kill. And there will be 10 merit points for the lucky man. Are there any questions?
Yes, sir. Who's playing the intruder?
A good friend of ours. He has just arrived by helicopter. You can't fail to recognize him. Bowler hat, impeccably dressed, carries an umbrella. Some of you may even know him. Steed. John Steed. Oh, yes. Off you go then, chap. Never get 10 points for the lucky man who kills him.
Mrs. Peel, in the interrogation room, heard the rumpus going on down the corridor. She said to the officer guarding her,
"Shouldn't we go and join him?"
"My orders were to see that you were remained here, alone."
"But those were alarm bells. This is an emergency. I really think we shouldn't be excluded. Let's go."
"Stay where you are. That's an order. Now don't get up or move."
"Oh, don't be such a silly soldier. That gun's not loaded."
"Oh, yes, it is. And I have no hesitation in firing it."
"Are you really serious?"
"Of course."
"But this is a training center. This isn't for real."
"Just stay where you are, or you'll find out."
"In that case, I think I shall have to accept your challenge."
Mrs. Peel, who had been sitting calmly on a wooden chair, rose to her feet and, grasping the chair back, flung it at him. When the revolver went off, Mrs. Peel moved in quickly. The fight didn't last long. Mrs. Peel got a good hold and threw the guard across the room. Mrs. Peel opened the door and stole quietly up the passage, just as John Steed opened one of the windows at the back of the house. There was a guard in the room.
"Stay where you are. Don't move. Come out from behind the curtain."
The guard advanced and bent down to see what had slumped to the floor. He drew the curtains apart. John Steed said,
"Good afternoon,"
and hit him with the steel rim of his bowler. Then chaos began to reign. Mrs. Peel, coming up the passage, ran straight into Rasker.
Here, Mrs. Peel, what are you doing?
Sorry, got a thing against firearms today.
Mrs. Peel did a splendid high kick and knocked Rasker's gun down the passage. A few moments later, Rasker followed it. John Steed, coming up the passage, stepped neatly over Rasker's body and picked up his gun just as Mullard and a crowd of other men raced up.
"Hands up, Steed."
Steed obliged.
"I say, but we're supposed to kill him, aren't we?"
"I saw him first."
"No, I did.
Now, just a minute, just a minute. Hold on, hold on.
It's mine, it's mine.
It's 10 points for the kill, isn't it? Well, then, there are 5 of us here. Why don't we all shoot at once and claim 2 points each?
I say, that's good. Good. Fair enough. Yeah,
right, right.
All right,
right
then.
I think so.
1, 2, 3.
No! No!
Mrs. Peel dashed forward, did a great leaping roll over the group of officers, and landed in front of Seed.
No!
I say!
Those guns are loaded with real bullets.
Oh, come now, Emma. You just want the 10 points for yourself.
Look, we've all been duped. This whole course is a fake.
She's right, you know.
Jolly good deal. Excellent. Testing their gullibility, eh? Trick them. See how they react to the persuasive talk of the enemy, eh?
Mannering is the enemy. I'm telling the truth.
Is she? Don't forget there are 10 merit points at stake, gentlemen.
Those guns are loaded with live ammunition. Please believe me.
Very convincing, but not quite convincing enough. Hey, gentlemen?
Might I make a suggestion? There's a simple way to see who's bluffing. Mallard, isn't it? Point your gun at Colonel Mannering and pull the trigger. I'll count to three. 1, 2...
All right, why not?
No! Don't shoot!
Mannering dived for the floor as the bullet crashed into a light. Steed stepped forward and hit Mannering hard on the back of the neck with his umbrella.
Gentlemen, shall we adjourn to the bar? I need a drink. Don't you, Mrs. Peel?
Avengers. Listen every evening, Monday to Friday, to John Steed and Emma Peel, The Avengers. Brought to you by the makers of Coldwater Omen. The Avengers. Donald Monat as John Steed and Diane Appleby as Emma Peel is adapted and directed by Dennis Faubig and produced by David Gooden.
Navy Day by Harry Harrison. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Frank Malanga. Navy Day by Harry Harrison. General Wingrove looked at the rows of faces without seeing them. His vision went beyond the Congress of the United States, past the balmy June day to another day that was coming, a day when the Army would have its destined place of authority. He drew a deep breath and delivered what was perhaps the shortest speech ever heard in the hallowed halls of Congress. The General Staff of the U.S. Army requests Congress to abolish the archaic branch of the armed forces known as the U.S. Navy. The aging senator from Georgia checked his hearing aid to see if it was an operating order, while the press box emptied itself in one concerted rush and a clatter of running feet that died off in the direction of the telephone room. A buzz of excited comment ran through the giant chamber. One by one, the heads turned to face the naval section, where rows of blue figures stirred and buzzed like smoked-out bees. The knot of men around a paunchy figure, heavy with gold braid, broke up, and Admiral Fitzjames climbed slowly to his feet. Lesser men have quailed before that piercing stare, but General Wingrove was never the lesser man. The admiral tossed his head with disgust, every line of his body denoting outraged dignity. He turned to his audience, a small pulse beating in his forehead. "I cannot comprehend the general's attitude, nor can I understand why he has attacked the Navy in this unwarranted fashion. The Navy has existed and will always exist as the first barrier of American defense. I ask you, gentlemen, to ignore this request as you would ignore the statements of any person, slightly demented. I should like to offer a recommendation that the general's sanity be investigated, and an inquiry be made as to the mental health of anyone else connected with this preposterous proposal." The general smiled calmly. "I understand, Admiral, and really don't blame you for being slightly annoyed. But please let us not bring this issue of national importance down to a shallow personal level. The Army has facts to back up this request, facts that shall be demonstrated tomorrow morning." Turning his back on the raging admiral, General Wingrove included all the assembled Solons in one sweeping gesture. "Reserve your judgment until that time, gentlemen. Make no hasty judgments until you have seen the force of argument with which we back up our request. It is the end of an era. In the morning, the Navy joins its fellow fossils, the Dodo and the Brontosaurus." The admiral's blood pressure mounted to a new record, and the gentle thud of his unconscious body striking the floor was the only sound to break the shocked silence of the giant hall. The early morning sun warmed the white marble of the Jefferson Memorial and glinted from the soldiers' helmets and the roofs of the packed cars that crowded forward in a slow-moving stream. All the gentlemen of Congress were there, the passage of their cars cleared by the screaming sirens of motorcycle policemen. Around and under the wheels of the official cars pressed a solid wave of government workers and common citizens of the capital city. The trucks of the radio and television services pressed close, microphones and cameras extended. The stage was set for a great day. Neat rows of olive-drab vehicles curved along the water's edge. Jeeps and half-tracks shouldered close by weapons carriers and six-bys, all of them shrinking to insignificance beside the looming patent tanks. A speaker's platform was set up in the center of the line near the audience. At precisely 10 a.m., General Wingrove stepped forward and scowled at the crowd until they settled into an uncomfortable silence. His speech was short and consisted of nothing more than amplifications of his opening statement that actions speak louder than words. He pointed to the first truck in line, a 2.5-ton filled with infantry squads sitting stiffly at attention. The driver caught the signal and kicked the engine into life. With a grind of gears, it moved forward towards the river's edge. There was an indrawn gasp from the crowd as the front wheels ground over the marble parapet, and then the truck was plunging down toward the muddy waters of the Potomac. The wheels touched the water, and the surface seemed to sink while taking on a strange, glassy character. The truck roared into high gear and rode forward on the surface of the water, surrounded by a saucer-shaped depression. It parked 200 yards offshore, and the soldiers, goaded by the sergeant's bark, leapt out and lined up with a showy, "Present arms!" The general returned the salute and waved to the remaining vehicles. They moved forward in a series of maneuvers that indicated a great number of rehearsal hours on some hidden pond. The tanks rumbled slowly over the water while the jeeps cut back and forth through their lines in intricate patterns. The trucks backed and turned like puffing ballerinas. The audience was rooted in a hushed silence, their eyeballs bulging. They continued to watch the amazing display as General Wingrove spoke again. "You see before you a typical example of Army ingenuity, developed in Army laboratories. These motor units are supported on the surface of the water by an intensifying of the surface tension in their immediate area. Their weight is evenly distributed over the surface, causing the shallow depressions you see around them. This remarkable feat has been accomplished by the use of the Dornifier, a remarkable invention that is named after that brilliant scientist, Colonel Robert A. Dorn, commander of the Brook Point Experimental Laboratory. It was there that one of the civilian employees discovered the Dorn effect, under the colonel's constant guidance, of course. Utilizing this invention, the Army now has become master of the sea as well as the land. Army convoys of trucks and tanks can blanket the world. The surface of the water is our highway, our motor park, our battleground, the airfield and a runway for our planes. Mechanics were pushing a shooting star onto the water. They stepped clear as flame gushed from the tailpipe. With the familiar whooshing rumble, it sped down the Potomac and hurled itself into the air. When this cheap and simple method of crossing oceans is adopted, it will, of course, mean the end of that fantastic medieval anachronism, the Navy. No need for billion-dollar aircraft carriers, battleships, dry docks, and all the other cumbersome junk that keeps those boats and things afloat. Give the taxpayer back his hard-earned dollar. Teeth grated in the naval section as carriers and battleships were called boats, and the rest of America's sea might lumped under the casual headings of things. Lips were curled at the transparent appeal to the taxpayer's pocketbook. But with leaden hearts, they knew that all this justified wrath and contempt would avail them nothing. This was Army Day with a vengeance, and the doom of the Navy seemed inescapable. The Army had made elaborate plans for what they called Operation Sinker. Even as the general spoke, the publicity mills ground into high gear. From coast to coast, the citizens absorbed the news with their morning nourishment. Agnes, you hear what the radio said? The Army's going to give a trip around the world in a B-36 as first prize in this limerick contest. All you have to do is fill in the last line and mail one copy to the Pentagon and the other to the Navy. The Navy mailroom had standing orders to burn all the limericks when they came in, but some of the newer men seemed to think the entire thing was a big joke. Commander Bullman found one in the mess hall. The Army will always be there, on the land, on the sea, in the air. So why should the Navy take all of the gravy, to which a seagoing scribe had added, and not give us ensigns our share? The newspapers were filled daily with photographs of mighty B-36s landing on Lake Erie and grinning soldiers making mock beachhead attacks on Coney Island. Each man wore a buzzing black box at his waist and walked on the bosom of the now quiet Atlantic like a biblical prophet. Radio and television also carried the thousands of news releases that poured in an unending flow from the Pentagon building. Cards, letters, telegrams, and packages descended on Washington in an overwhelming torrent. The Navy Department was the unhappy recipient of deprecatory letters and a vast quantity of little cardboard battleships. The people spoke, and their representatives listened closely. This was an election year. There didn't seem to be much doubt as to the decision, particularly when the reduction in the budget was considered. It took Congress only 2 months to make up its collective mind. The people were all pro-Army. The novelty of the idea had fired their imaginations. They were about to take the final vote in the lower house. If the amendment passed, it would go to the states for ratification, and their votes were certain to follow that of Congress. The Navy had fought a last-ditch battle to no avail. The balloting was going to be pretty much of a sure thing. The wet water Navy would soon become ancient history. For some reason, the admirals didn't look as unhappy as they should. The Navy Department had requested one last opportunity to address the Congress. Congress had patronizingly granted permission, for even the doomed man is allowed one last speech. Admiral Fitzjames, who had recovered from his choleric attack, was the appointed speaker. Gentlemen of the Congress of the United States, we in the Navy have a fighting tradition. We damn the torpedoes and sail straight ahead into the enemy's fire if that is necessary. We have been stabbed in the back. We have suffered a second Pearl Harbor sneak attack. The Army relinquished its rights to fair treatment with this attack. Therefore, we are counterattacking. Worn out by his attacking and mixed metaphors, the Admiral mopped his brow. Our laboratories have been working night and day on the perfection of a device we hoped we would never be forced to use. It is now in operation, having passed the final trials a few days ago. The significance of this device cannot be underestimated. We are so positive of its importance that we are demanding that the Army be abolished. He waved his hand toward the window and bellowed one word, "Look!" Everyone looked. They blinked and looked again. They rubbed their eyes and kept looking. Sailing majestically up the middle of Constitution Avenue was the battleship Missouri. The Admiral's voice rang through the room like a trumpet of victory. "The Mark I debinder, as you see, temporarily lessens the binding energies that hold molecules of solid matter together. Solids become liquids, and a ship equipped with this device can sail anywhere in the world, on sea or land. Take your vote, gentlemen. The world awaits your decision." The End. End of Navy Day by Harry Harrison. Recording by Frank Malanga, Pembroke Pines, Florida.
Stories of sudden and mysterious disappearances are not uncommon, and according to the familiar pattern, a perfectly ordinary human being drops out of sight, leaving not a single trace behind. And this is the pattern followed in the strange case of the two missing airmen, with one important exception. They did leave traces behind, clear and unmistakable traces, which led exactly nowhere.
On July 24, 1924, at 9 o'clock in the morning, two officers, Lieutenant W.T. Day and Pilot Officer D.R. Stewart, took off from the British airdrome near Tehran on a routine reconnaissance mission. They were scheduled to return not later than noon. But noon came, 1 o'clock and 2, and still they did not appear. Back at the airdrome, two of their fellow officers, Captain Bellows and Lieutenant Fielding, scanned the sky impatiently.
"I don't like it, Fielding.
What could possibly have happened to them?"
"Engine trouble, most likely. Or perhaps they ran out of petrol. They've been forced down somewhere in the desert."
And so the two men set out in search of their missing comrades. They flew low over the desert. And for a half hour or more, they saw nothing beneath them but vast, billowing waves of sand. And then Lieutenant Fielding tugged sharply at the captain's arm. A half-mile distant, silent and motionless and alone, squatted the missing plane. The other plane swooped swiftly down toward it, then came taxiing up to its side.
"Day! Stewart! Where are you, men?"
But there was no answer to their calls. Shielding their eyes from the sun, they turned slowly, scanning the desert on all sides of them.
"What could have happened to them, sir?" "They couldn't have gone far enough to be out of sight. Perhaps if we knew what brought them down, sir..."
"Good idea. Look in the tank."
"It's half full, sir."
Captain Bellows climbed into the cockpit, and the lieutenant spun the propeller.
"There's nothing the matter with that engine, sir."
"I'm sure they could have gone back if they tried." "I've heard of a lot of strange things, but I've never heard of anything that plucks planes out of the sky. At least not till..."
Captain, look. Footprints. Two pairs of them. And they're not ours, sir."
Like bloodhounds who have found the scent, the two men followed the trail of footprints across the sand. For 40 yards they walked, their hearts pounding with excitement. And then...
"The prints. Where are they?"
"They stopped dead right here. Day and Stewart walked this far. Heaven only knows what happened to them after that."
Yes, those were the last traces of the missing airmen. Now, it has been suggested that they were carried off by hostile Bedouins who carefully brushed away their trail. But such an explanation is inadequate in view of the fact that a search was carried on by planes and armored cars and tribal patrols for 4 days and nights, and no renewal of the trail was ever found. Where they had gone remains the secret of the desert, a secret incredible but true.
Arthur, how would you pronounce L-O-N-G?
Why, long, of course.
That's right. Now, how do you pronounce L-O-N-G-E-R?
Longer. What is this, fifth grade recitation?
No, it's just my way of reminding you that king-size wing cigarettes are 20% longer. Which means wings are cooler and smoother. Get a pack of longer, cooler, smoother king-size wing cigarettes.
Up next is another import from South Africa, Beyond Midnight, which was a horror series written and produced by Michael McCabe for the South African Broadcast Corporation's Springbok radio service. This program doesn't really seem to have had a host. Some episodes do have a framing narration. You know, people will kind of talk their way in and then kind of talk their way out. While others, kind of like the one tonight, just start the story. I figure there probably was a host whose openings have been left off the recordings. Or it could be that there was a script for a live announcer to read when it first aired. And like so many things in old-time radio, this has been lost, too. There are 71 episodes which are known to have survived of the run of Beyond Midnight between November the 1st of 1968 and May the 24th of 1970. Tonight's story illustrates that a practical joke can be a really bad idea. Personally, I think practical jokes are pretty much always bad ideas and almost never funny. In this case, it's a lot less than not funny. And who in their right mind would play a practical joke on an old man who keeps the morgue? I wouldn't. Here we have it. Beyond Midnight. Don't joke in the morgue.
It was Bradley's idea. It was a dull night, and in the dingy little room at headquarters where the reporters on the police beat gathered, Bradley, of the Express, tired of playing three-handed stud and waiting for something to happen.
I've had it.
Well, what do you mean, you've had it?
I've had it. H-A-D-F-I-T-F. I've had it. The man's had it. Yep. I guess I've had it, too. I reckon I'll go home. Hey, tell you what. Let's play a joke on old Pop.
Huh? Let's play a joke on old Pop. Pop Henderson was the night attendant on duty at the morgue in the basement of the building. Funny place to play a joke. Funny person. Play a joke on Pop Henderson, watchman at the morgue. But Bradley was like that, you see. He was a jokester. And that's how it all began. The hour had gone long beyond midnight.
Biotex, the new soak and pre-wash powder, presents Beyond Midnight by Michael McCabe.
How about it?
How about what?
Let's get old Pop a little bit, huh? What do you say?
No, leave old Pop alone. He's not very bright. Should have been retired years ago.
Slow-witted.
So he's slow-witted. Well, you gotta be working in the morgue. So who cares? So he's slow-witted. I got a gag. BLF. Morgan?
Huh?
Let's go and get old Pop a bit, huh?
I don't care. I've had enough.
I gotta wait until the paper's gone to bed.
Sure.
What kind of joke, Bradley? A joke, boy. Wait and see.
He's an old guy. He's never been retired, anyhow. His age, huh?
Well, he's got obligations. Gotta work. Wife's an invalid. He needs the dough.
Now, what does he do all night long in the morgue, then? Read? Does he read or something?
Read? He can't see your hand 3 feet from his face. No, he don't read.
Listen to the radio?
How should I know?
How about it, huh?
Night watchman in the morgue.
Well, little Johnny, what do you want when you're all grown up and leave school? Please, teacher, I want to be night watchman at the city morgue.
Come on, you guys. It's a bad night. Need something. Huh? What do you say? What do you say, Morgan?
Morgan the morgue.
Now, leave Pop alone. He's old.
So he's old, for Pete's sake. So everybody don't laugh anymore just because they get old? Come on.
Oh, yeah, why not? Come on, let's go on down. See old Pop.
Boy, hey, maybe Pop's got booze down in the morgue.
Oh, yeah, okay.
I get all those compartments and don't stack this at all. He keeps bottles of my whiskey there for the picker.
Bradley was an inveterate practical joker. He had a reputation for thinking up original gags. To him, it was the joke that counted. He didn't care whom it was on. Pop Henderson sat in his tiny office. He was long past retiring age, but he had commitments. He didn't read or listen to the radio. He just sat night after night waiting for his shift to be over. Along one wall of the main room were 20 compartments, about 18 by 24 inches, just big enough to hold a full-grown man, providing, of course, he had no intention of turning over. And no one who occupied one of the compartments ever did. They were refrigerated, with the temperature below freezing.
Hey there, Pop. We'd like to see number 11. Just had a tip. He may be that missing New York banker.
Number 11?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
What are you going to do, Brad?
Shut up.
Number 11, Pop.
There you are, boys. Is it the one you're looking for?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Looks like him, okay. Now, listen, get the record on this guy for us, Pop, will you?
Okay, Mr. Bradley. Okay.
Okay, Morgan, come with me. Fur, you go with Pop. Keep him in the office.
Furness followed the old man out, and Bradley and Morgan got busy preparing for the joke. Furness kept Pop in the office, pretending to look through the papers of number 11, until Morgan came in.
Oh, there's no need to bother, Pop. Yeah, guess we made a mistake. You can put 11 back to bed. Come on, sir. Let's go back. Play a few more hands.
Okay.
The two newspaper men went back upstairs, and Pop, methodically, put away the papers in their file. Then, with the same slow, unhurrying movements of a man who is waiting out his life on a job, he trudged back into the big morgue room toward the open compartment, the extended slab, and the sheeted figure lying on it. He was a dozen feet from it when the sheet stirred. And the sheeted figure slowly sat up.
Where am I? What have you done to me? What have you done to me? You tried to kill me.
Wait, see? He's alive. He's come back. Stop. Come quick. One of the cops is alive. You really come on down, sir. One of the cops is alive.
Stop. Oh, boy.
Oh, you scared the pants off him, okay? Now, come on, get the cards out quick before the sergeant gets down here. His officer's given the worst disposition in the state, and he will be sore.
He stayed up and looked at me. He did, sir.
Oh, boy, you should have seen his face. Hey, what's the matter with you guys, huh? Great gag. Morgan, you look like it's Christmas and you don't have a dime.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Ha, ha. Funny, huh? Some cut up, huh? The real comic kiss from Funnyville. Great. I'm laughing like I'm dying.
Did you see his face? He's as sore as a boil on a camel's back. Hey, what's the matter with you two guys? Can't you laugh at a joke?
Yeah, I'm going out. If the shop calls, tell them I'm checking on the story.
Sore head. Well, maybe it wasn't such a good idea after all. Oh, well, guess I'll go out and have a quick one and go home. Faber's gone to bed anyway. Now, hey, why? Come on, play cards, something.
No, I don't want to play cards.
Yeah, but you can't go home.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to do, okay?
Sure, great. You give a couple of guys a laugh and they don't want to know no more. Like, laughs is easy to come by in this lousy place.
See you, Brad.
Yeah, see ya, happy guy. Don't see something funny outside and bust your sides. Hate a guy who can't take a joke. Go home to bed. Who wants to go home to bed? I don't want to go home to bed. Oh, hi, Pop.
You should not have done that, Mr. Bradley. Gave me a bad turn. I don't mind that. Thing is, you got me into trouble with Sergeant Roberts. He keeps complaining about me anyhow. And me busting in on him just now got him real mad.
Yeah, well, you see, Pop,
when we got down there and found all the corpses just like they should be, first he said I was imagining things. Then when I said you press fellas had just been dying, he figured out it was just one of your jokes.
Yeah, Pop, well, there
he said
it is.
If I fell for any more jokes or made any more mistakes, he'd see to it I'd have to resign, like I should have done years ago. And I can't resign. I've got to have the money. So, Mr. Bradley, no more jokes, please.
And Bradley looked around him at the dingy little office and felt bad. Not for what he'd done to Pop, but because the night had suddenly turned sour on him. His friends had gone, and Bradley felt lonely and unwanted, and a bit stupid.
Yeah, well, I guess that was the fastest that old man's moved for more than 20 years. Guess I'll ring the paper and go home. No, I don't want to go home.
And that was Bradley's biggest mistake. He should have gone home. He should have gone home there and then. If he had, what happened after in the morning's small hours wouldn't have happened. But it did happen, because Bradley, you see, was a jokester with no taste. No taste at all.
Smoke rings anymore. Can't make smoke rings at all. I need a laugh. I need something.
Oh, sitting desk, please. Extension. Oh, yeah, yeah. Good, thanks. Oh, hi. Sitting desk. Express, Bradley. All quiet here. They were gone to bed. Good, okay. I'm going home. Don't look for me till tomorrow. So...
take him to a bar near the docks after playing a joke on an old man. And in that bar...
Okay.
Mother. He looked around. It was late. Close to 3 a.m. The bar was empty, almost. Just him, the bartender, and a leathery-looking little fellow with his foot on the brass rail drinking beer. The bartender looked like a man who could laugh, and the little fellow... Well, he'd have to. He was too scrawny to do anything else. Bradley, the jokester, thinks of a gag. He bends over, as if to tie his shoelace. Deftly... He slips a match in between the sole and the upper of the little drinker's shoe. He lights the match and straightens up again and orders another drink.
Give me another, bartender, if you please.
Sure, Pop. Hey, watch. Wait.
What? Hey, what's going on? What's the big idea, huh?
The little leathery man hopped and skipped and frantically tried to put out the burning match in his shoe. Then he saw Bradley laughing. And without another word, he swung. Bradley just had time to feel a wicked snap somewhere at the base of his skull, and all the lights went out for him.
Big slob, giving me a hard foot. Me, Kid Wilkins.
You hit him kind of hard, Kid. He's lying awful
quiet. Just a left of the mouth. Losing a couple of teeth, that's all. Next time he'll think twice when he goes around playing them kind of gags.
Yeah, but his head, it's twisted kind of funny. Just suppose... Yeah. He's dead. Dead as a nice smelt.
Dead? What? It was an accident. I didn't hit him hard. It was an accident, see?
Sure, Kid, sure. Accident. Wait, I've got to make lots of places close.
Accident, that's all it was. Get up, you slob.
This ain't good, Kid. I've got enough trouble with the cops without nobody dying in here. And you've got a couple of assault and battery charges standing against you already. Kid. This ain't just bad. This is no good at all. This slob's a reporter from the Express.
I'm a fool.
Almost as bad as
a
cop.
I have to get me a hot foot. And I have to hit him. And he has to break his lousy neck. Why? Tell me why.
Never mind the why. I got an idea. We got to get him out of here. Over by the docks, we'll dump him. Make it look like he got mugged. Or maybe he was plastered and took a bad dump.
Yeah, Mark. My ship sails 6 a.m. I just won't come back to this port. If anybody traces him here, he went out loaded when you locked up. You don't know from nothing.
That's it. Come on. First we take all his stuff. So they take longer identifying him. Then we take him out, okay?
Okay, Mike, okay. Anything you say.
Consciousness abruptly, semi-consciousness rather, enough to know he was still alive. He tried to move, but his body was numb, and his muscles would not obey. He felt no pain, no sensations of any kind. He couldn't even be sure in what position he was lying, though he thought he was on his back. Someone bending over him. He thought he recognized who it was, too. But everything kept jumping. The lights hurt his eyes. He still couldn't move his body. Then he discovered he could speak. Just.
Bob. 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 Edmondson.
Yes, it was Pop. And the place was the morgue. The old man went on, oblivious, straightening Bradley out. He was sort of hard of hearing, you see. Bradley tried again.
I'm alive.
The stooped attendant turned, frowning. Had he heard something? Was there something in the room? What was it? Bradley tried again with tremendous effort.
Me? Dave Bradley? It's me, Dave Bradley. Bradley, I'm alive. Get her. Doctor. Quirkin.
Bradley. Mr. Bradley. I didn't know you with your face all swelled up like that. Nobody knew you.
Never. I
Pop Henderson looked troubled and uncertain. Then he picked up the sheet and folded it.
Mr. Bradley, I told you before, no more jokes. Once tonight is enough, Mr. Bradley. Once is enough.
And he spread the sheet over the recumbent figure, covering it.
Sarge Roberts wouldn't stand for me getting fooled again. No, Mr. Bradley. Not twice the same night.
And unhurriedly, he pushed the sliding slab into the compartment and closed the door marked 12. And turned the knob that held it shut. The body of Bradley wrapped in its sheet and safely behind the door of compartment 12, the old morgue night watchman, Pop Henson, plodded back to his office and sat down to wait patiently for the end of his shift.
That was the 1901 Edison recording of The Beautiful Isle of Somewhere, as sung by John McCormick. I'm Gary Clinton, and maybe I'll see you somewhere.